Welcome to the NutGallery.com podcast. This is Jason James, and today this is a special edition podcast where I interview Jesse Cowell, who is the writer and director of Drawn by Pain, a series that is being released online at drawnbypain.com, and is a very good series. I really think you should check it out, but I hope you listen to the interview first. You're on your final leg of your episodic series Drawn by Pain. Can you start out by telling us a little bit about it?
Well, the story itself is something I thought of about 8 years ago, maybe nine now at this point. And I just had this gem of an idea for a little girl that was sort of in an abusive family situation. Her father was being abusive to her. And she loves anime. And to sort of escape the pain and torture of what's going on in the situation, you know, she draws, and eventually, when the father winds up, you know, murdering her mother, she, out of pure rage, fury, whatever you want to say, passion, so on and so forth, the drawings come to life to defend her. And that was the idea that I had 8 years ago, and which brings us to now, and I sort of started to explore the idea and say, hey, you know, that's a good start, and it's an interesting little short film. But where can I go from there? And I didn't want to make a film that just sort of, you know, went on with the exploits of this little girl. What I was more curious about, the real story to me, was what would that little girl who went through this experience of, you know, this obviously this fantastical experience, but more so like a psychologically torturing one, and one that she was had to rise up. And what happens in the story in the first episode is, she father. So what kind of person would be resulted from that as a grown woman? And that's mainly where the story takes place, is dealing with the psychological ramifications of being this sort of, you know, vengeful, angry person, and will this person be okay in the long run?
What kind of equipment are you using to make this then?
Well, my old movies I shot on digital video on DV, and I've done a little bit of everything. I've done some, you know, Super 8, and I've done some 16mm, and a lot of video, a lot of digital video. But, you know, I've always found that without the proper equipment, as in like resolution-wise, there's a lot of sort of snobbishness against it from, you know, the industry and even people in general. If something doesn't look like immaculately clean, or if it doesn't look like film, you get sort of like the perception that this isn't worth watching, which is, you know, it's kind of sad because a good story can be told on, you know, a flipbook, a listed response on a flipbook. But you get the point, which is that you can tell a good story even with, like, hand gestures. So it's not really about the level of equipment. It's about, you know, the story you have to tell. But that said, there's sort of a perception that you need to come forward with something that's very polished. So for this one, I upped the stakes a little bit, and I went, because they had a new camera that was coming out, and I bought this Panasonic HVX 200, which is the sort of first all-digital, shoots on little hard drives, you know, camera of its class to be able to release for a price that was within the reach of somebody like me, i.e. somebody that had a good amount of credit on credit cards. And we're not talking DV. I mean, you know, the camera and all this kind of high-def equipment, the camera itself was like, including the cards, maybe like $7,000. And, you know, to some people that may seem like a lot, you know. And to me it's a lot, too. I'm just a regular guy, a working guy. But if you compare what it can do, the kind of image that it can turn out the same way, when you look at this thing, it doesn't look like some a cheap little project. It doesn't look like some amateurly shot thing, because this camera can turn out images that are so pristine and so interesting looking that the high def makes it totally worth the long-term bankruptcy of me, basically. So I'm using that, and I'm, you know, editing on a couple different systems, but you know, mainly I use Avid Express Pro HD, and you know, pipe it through the computer and then just put it out and compress it for the web.
Can you maybe mention how the adding in animation works?
Sure.
I know you do work with somebody on that.
Yes, Erica Langworthy is my animator, and she is amazing. Basically what we do, since it's all digital, we went out and we got a Cintiq, which is like, you know what a Wacom tablet is? Like those things that you draw on,
yeah,
on the screen? They're pressure sensitive, so you,
yep,
can actually draw on them. Well, what a Cintiq is, it's made by the same people who make Wacom. So it's like basically a monitor, like a 20-inch monitor, that you draw on with the same pressure sensitivity as the Wacom tablet. So what it allows her to do is it allowed us to skip the process of using paper, which was going to be a nightmare. We did a lot of tests when we first started out, for like the first year, year and a half, of like how the hell are we going to get pictures on the screen? I don't know. You know, I had never done anything like this. So we're doing a lot of tests where she would draw things and scan them, and then we try to, you know, composite them in, and it was a nightmare because, you know, going through thousands of pieces of paper and then the scanning time alone was, like, prohibitive. So we nixed that, and we got this Cintiq so that she could draw directly into and onto the images. And the reason I say into, it's onto, really, because she has the frame, she draws them, and then I composite them back in, but I like to say into as well because she sort of draws, like, behind things. And, like, you know, like, there's a shot in the first episode where she's looking in this little toy, her little dancing figurine, in a mirror. And we could have just, you know, made this of her, the reflection, but I made sure that she did it so that you could still see the dancer in the foreground. So it's important to do that to keep sort of layers inside the video so that, you know, that the perception is not always that the image is not on top of it, but it's inside of it. That's basically how we do the animation. Then I just composite them together inside of Avid using, you know, just keying out the black or the alpha channels. And there it is. It's really not that complicated. It's just massively time-consuming because she draws each and every frame of animation. So what most people would think would be like, you know, some sort of flash program or this and that where you draw one frame for every five frames of video or you have something repeat over and over and over, or you just had a character not moving. Like you see a lot of anime stuff where you see the background's not moving at all and the character's not moving, but just the mouth is moving. But I kind of wanted something different, so I had her animate each and every frame so that the characters flicker a little bit. And each and every frame is supposed to be different. So you get that sort of like stuttering look, kind of like the cartoons of like the 30s and 40s, so that the idea of this being a living sketch is conveyed. And I think it looks, you know, pretty cool and pretty different. You know, to go for something super polished would have been like sort of anti the theme of the story, I think. That's sort of the process. Is that pretty clear?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm really interested in how you're saying that because we often talk about how Disney's kind of lost the art of doing frame-by-frame animation.
Right, exactly. And Erica, she'd be the first to agree with you because she loves traditional animation. And she's also really interested in 3D. But she loves traditional animation, and she feels like it's a real shame that they've gotten away from it. And some of them are actually getting back to it. But the problem with it is it's just so time-consuming, you know, and then people got used to. What happened is people love the glitz of 3D, and it looks great, and it's amazing. Don't get me wrong. And I love Shrek and all these movies, too. But they got so carried away with it that they forgot, you know, the sort of, you know, cartoon look that a lot of people, A, grew up on, and B, people enjoy. I mean, when 3D sort of got carried away and you started to see it in everything, it sort of lost its luster. And you kind of, I think you kind of long a little bit for something that's a little more traditional.
Yeah, they've kind of merged the realism of the animation maybe a little too much.
Yeah, I agree. And then some of it, like, you know, Beowulf, which I enjoyed, you know, and I think Zemeckis is an amazing director, but at this point, it's like some of the images are getting a little creepy looking, you know? I mean, they're real, but they're not real, and it's a little sort of like, feels like you're in a wax museum. A little odd. But I think that, you know, Erica's really done a great job of sort of, you know, coming up with something traditional and, you know, having the characters look interesting and the way that I'm responsible, obviously, for the shots and the direction of what she does, you know, because it's, you know, it's my concept and I sort of am supposed to run the general intention behind everything. But that said, she brings so much to the table as far as, you know, the way that the characters look, the way that the characters feel, and the way that they move, like the way that their muscles move and sort of the emotion within that. And I think she's done a great job.
I agree. It works real well for your movie.
Well, thank you.
What kind of budget are you working with on this project? I know you've mentioned your credit cards and stuff.
Well, lack thereof anymore, but it's getting kind of out of control. It's kind of hard to say. My budget is tricky because my budget always includes the equipment, which I can then use again and again and again, you know? So let's say basically, I don't have a lot of help, you know. My job is to make this film. My intention is to make this film, which is, well, the reason I call it a film is because all these things are being joined together as they were supposed to be originally, to make a feature. You're just seeing it in sort of episodic form. And when you eventually, you know, maybe 6 months from now, there'll be the feature version of it on DVD or whatever, wherever we can get it. So, going back to budget, I don't want to lose myself per se, but going back to budget, it's really tough to say. Because I don't have a big team, which is where I was going with that. I don't have a team of 30, but I'm trying to make it look like 30 people made this movie. So I have to cut a lot of corners. So there's no accountant to tell me, you spent X. There's nobody tracking anything. I just spend what I need to spend against it, you know? But I would say I pay for every meal for everybody. When somebody needs something, they got it. We need software, I'll buy it. We need, you know, a piece of equipment, I got it. You know, I bought all the equipment. So I'd probably say I've spent on this thing 40 to 50 grand, but I own all the equipment. No idea. Don't tell my tax guy that.
Maybe a better question is maybe a little bit, can you tell us a little bit about maybe the casting process?
Sure. We took out an ad in Backstage, which is a paper in New York and in L.A., which all the actors look in each week to see what the available parts are that they can submit for. And it's a lot of sort of independent stuff and some mainstream stuff, open casting calls and stuff like that. And with that, whenever you do that in New York, as I had learned, I lived in L.A. for a little bit, you get like, I don't know, it's crazy. You get like 1,000 headshots in the mail, if not more. And you have to sift through these to figure out who you want to even call. And they all look, they're attractive and they have big resumes. You don't even know what to do at that point. So it's very overwhelming when you do it. And I rented a studio space at this place called, I think, Pam Grier. No, that's a 70s black exploitation actress. That doesn't make any sense. But it's called Ripley. we rented a space because, you don't want to do this thing from your house. I've done everything on the cheap for so long, I've gotten really good at it. But I used to, I'll just come to my dorm room, and we'll audition and then go and shoot, something real quick. But in this case, I want it to be even more professional. And I've done casting calls before where we had student space, but I needed to rent a space because you want people to take you seriously, When they come to the audition, it's important to set the tone for the actors coming in that will be set for the entire rest of the production, should you select them and should they want to be in the film. They have to meet in the middle. Because if they think you're a pro and they think that, you believe in what you're doing and you know what you're doing, they're going to commit to the project. But if they think that you're a bunch of jokers, they may show up for one day and then never show up again because you don't really have money to pay them. It's very tricky how you sort of relate to the people that are helping you on a project like this. And I think that the reason or you have a lot of friends who say, oh, yeah, I want to make a movie, and then you never hear anything about it, because it's impossible to keep a team together. It's a real art form to keep a team motivated and loyal and confident in what's going on. That's very difficult. But the more projects you make, the easier it gets. So I had to set that tone. So we rented this studio space, and all the I went through the headshots. That took me a while. And then me and two of the people involved in the production, friends, really, and were there while the actors came in, and we saw one every 20 minutes for 3 days straight, And we saw as many as we could, and then we just selected the best ones of that.
Wow.
Everything is a process. If I was to break it down to you, your head would explode. Because, it's much more complicated than people think to make something like this. Because there's a reason when you watch the credits on a film, there are hundreds and hundreds of names. Because everybody has a little responsibility. But when you have no money and you have to make it seem like those jobs are being done by somebody else, it's very tricky. Because you come across, if your movie sucks, nobody cares that you didn't have help. It's just the way it is. And if it's great, nobody cares if you didn't have help. They just want to watch the movie.
Well, I'd have to say you did a really good job, because so far into it, it's really seems like the characters are very well cast.
Thank you.
I, especially the little girl, she did a phenomenal job.
Oh, she's such a great kid, and I got just really lucky. I think her and the older version of her came in the same day, and we just happened to some reason get two girls who look exactly the same. And I don't know, that's just a stroke of luck. And those are the two that I selected, and they look like each other, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think so.
Kind of creepy.
It's believable.
At least. But I'm glad you enjoy it. What do you like about it?
Well, I think that you definitely can pull raw emotion out. I thought so, especially in that first episode with the girl going through the trials and the kind of the horrors of her life. I mean, you wanted to reach through and beat the snot out of her dad.
he's a great character actor, man. I needed somebody for the father part that could be scary from step one. Like, and you know, though, you know, it may, even if it plays big, that's okay, because you don't have a lot of time to get him across. And he has to resonate for the entire rest of the film. So I needed an actor that could, like, walk in the room and you're frightened. And I think that guy has not only the face, but the intensity, not unlike many people I've seen. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think that's probably the big draw for me, is just how well you capture the emotion of the situation.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that the whole film is sort of based on emotion, and you know, hopefully people like it. It's funny because I feel odd even talking about it. I always feel sort of arrogant, you know, stating what I think of my own film. I just want people to watch it, and hopefully these things work, you know, and come across and that people enjoy it. As far as the first episode goes, what I tried to create for it, and I was worried. My biggest concern was, because it's very montage driven. In other words, like, you know, there's a lot of shots from a lot of different parts of her life, and they're all told through her eyes. I was very worried that this thing was a little too eclectic, a little too, a little too random for people to understand. That was my concern, you know? What I was trying to achieve, and I hope I have, is just creating not so much a logical progression of what's emotional and a visceral one. So that by the end of it, this montage of images is built you into a fury that's sort of, that the little girl, you and the little girl will share. So that when the animation finally comes to life, you're just so happy for her to take vengeance on her father. I want you to sort of be her, if that's possible, you know, or as at least close to it as I could get.
You did well with it. It came across very well.
Oh, thank you. Tried. Because, like, you know, the first episode is so important because it sets up who this woman is. See, the important thing is that the reason I kept bringing back the little girl later on, and she'll come back again and again and again, because you realize quickly that this older woman, you know, has not really escaped that moment in her life. It's like 10 years later, and she's still that little girl, that angry, fierce child. And that's why it's so important for the first part of this thing to be effective, because that character will come back and back and back. And even if it comes back in the form of the older woman, striking out, it's still the little girl.
What's your background in movie making?
I started making films when I was 18, pretty seriously. And I'm 34, so I've been doing it for 16 years. It's been a bit. And it seems like 2 days, but it's been 16 years. The only time it seems like 16 years is when I realize how hard I've worked, and I get frustrated because I'm not where I want to be yet, and that sort of requires people like yourself, you know, and like Jason, my friend, and putting the word out there and just telling everybody they know and say, this thing is amazing, now I'm letting the power of, you know, word of mouth make this work, and, you know, maybe donating $10 or something. Just make sure that credit cards don't overwhelm me. So I started when I was 18, and I went to school in Albany, New York. And I had a film teacher who was amazing. A little bit of a kook, but in a good way. And, very old school, very silent film, you know. And very less is more. Taught me a lot about less is more, that you didn't need to overdo it to get across your point. That you didn't need a lot to make the message clear. And how to communicate visually instead of just through dialogue. And then I went and I decided to, you know, try to get into a good film school because I thought that was the right path. And that's the way I'll go. That will get me my career. And I was, you know, I was in Albany. Everybody thought I was, you know, most likely to, that kind of thing. And got a lot of nice compliments because I made a lot, you know, what people liked, a lot of good films. And then I got into USC and I was like, okay, I got into USC, the, you know, supposed top films. And I got into there for my grad degree. And I went out to L.A. and I, you know, killed my student loans. and it was very expensive. And then I got out of there, you know, and had a difficult run there because it was very competitive and I felt a very nasty environment. I wasn't too happy with it. My experience in Albany was amazing, you know. Everybody was using each other, you know, as, I don't know, springboards. And at USC, it was more stepping stones. It was not fun. And I got out and I just rebelled against that. I immediately made this movie called Shades of Grey. It was a feature film that I made on DV, digital video. And everybody loved it that I had shown. But when I got out and I had a screening for it, I couldn't get anybody to show up and watch it as far as industry went. And I had a sort of big reoccurring problem with that. I stayed there for another 3-4 years after school. I wrote like 7 more screenplays. And no matter what I did, even though I was, you know, touted or told from many people that I had what it took to be there and even left all my family and friends to be there, and I couldn't even get anybody to reject me, much less accept me. They just ignored me. Like, I didn't exist. I was just some guy who lived there, and nobody would read a script, and nobody would take a phone call, and I'm not the type to go and smooth in a bar to get ahead, you know, and that's how it kind of is in L.A., and, you know, I always just wanted to belong to it, and I couldn't even... It was, like, impenetrable. And I said, it was so corrupt and unfair. I just said, this is ridiculous. And I got so frustrated that eventually I said, you know, screw this. Screw you guys. I'm going home. And like Cartman, you know. And I went back to New York. And, you know, I was like, oh, my God, what happened to me? You know, it's like devastated. And it worked so hard. I mean, I can't even, Jason, I can't even tell you how hard I've worked. I mean, like, the stress level for so many years. And my friends all have nice cars, and I get a big piece of shit, and, but I got a computer, that kind of thing. And I came back to New York, and I was just shattered, and I said, well, what do I do now? You know, and I still want to love the game and make sure this is what I wanted to do. And I started working for a video compression company, and I was doing compression all day, and I'm like, well, what do I got, you know? Well, I got my feature film that nobody had ever seen, you know, which is a shame. But the people who had seen it, they used to copy it and give it to all their friends because they loved it so much, this feature that I had made. So I said, I know, I'll put the whole thing on the internet. And the second I did, I started to get, you know, supporters for it, you know. And a lot of people know I don't really love the word fan. I like the word friend or supporter a little bit more. Because, you know, I guess I'm a fan of things, like, but at the same time, I'm more a supporter of it. And I just don't like the sort of arrogance that it sort of connotates for me. Like, it makes me feel like I don't fans. It's weird. I just want to have buddies, you know. So... But if I got a fan, I'll live. I'm not going to die. So I started putting this online, and I got all this response to my movie, and everybody loved Shades of Grey, and it was like on and on and on about, you know, this and that. And, you know, we're not talking huge people. You know, Shades of Grey has been seen probably hundreds of thousands of times at this point. DVDs were being copied, and we had this thing where we put the torrent file for the DVD up, and I made this DVD, and I sent out 150 copies for free, and I printed each one by hand, and I handwritten notes, and I just wanted to let people know how much I appreciated them, because, like, I came from the background of nobody giving a shit, like, nobody cared, nobody wanted to see myself, so even one person, you know, comes out, and, like, even if we didn't do this as an interview, and you didn't have people listening to it, I'd tell you this story, too, if I had the time, because it's important for me to be heard after all those years of just being invisible and after going into an art form that I'm not supposed to be invisible, I'm supposed to be able to communicate. So it's kind of messed up, you know? So I had all these young kids and older kids and, you know, whatever. And it's just, everybody was just so supportive of me and eventually they donated. But in the beginning, I wouldn't accept a dime from them. I was just like, I don't care if I'm broke. You just take it. I'd fly all over and just show it to them. But eventually that grew, which is awesome, and I had this, you know, support base, and, you know, we'd go vote on a website for me 100,000 times. It was awesome. And then these guys and girls, whatever, they started to throw screenings for me. Where one was in Wisconsin. I flew into there. This guy John decided he wanted to throw a screening, so he, you know, paid for the venue, paid for the plane fare, paid for the hotel, and he flew me in. And then everybody else would fly in and join him and watch the film, and it was like this really awesome sort of community experience that I was forming. And then I started to do this sort of reality show of my own called Jeff Kid TV. Everybody knows me as Jeff Kid. And it was all about, this is before all the YouTube stuff got real big, and it was just like about me just, you know, sitting around my house, and what do I do with myself? And it was pretty funny, I think, at times. But, you know, it contained some real struggle of trying to be noticed and the frustration that went with it, and then the little successes. And my first big thing was I got into this festival in Chicago with Shades of Grey, this film festival, and I was, like, all psyched, and, I had tears on camera. It was just because I had never been accepted in any way, shape, or form after all those years and after doing everything right. And everybody, and the big experience was that everybody flew in to be with me at that festival, and they had, like, 40 of us or something, 30 of us wearing all the same shirts, and the festival thought we were like a cult. It was awesome. And so that all led us up to, then I decided, okay, I've done Shades of Grey. That was a while back. I hadn't made another movie, a complete one. I made this reality show, but I hadn't made, like, another complete movie in about 4 or 5 years. You know, Shades of Grey took me, like, 4 or 5 years. On and off, because I was working full-time. And the first year I did principal production and editing, and then I just put it down for like 2-3 years, and then I came back at it and started editing it again. You know, I had so much other stuff. I was screenwriting for so long, too. That took up a lot of time, too. To make another, opus project or whatever you want to call it, where you think, this is going to be the one, that kind of thing. After Shades of Grey and the Jeff Kidd TV, I said, and a lot of little short films, I've done maybe 30 or 40 short films, I decided it was time to make something else. And I had this idea for, Drawing My Pain, like I said, all those years ago. And then I met Erica online, and I saw her animated drawings. And I said, I asked her, do you want to, are you interested in maybe doing this? And she thought I was, totally full of shit, when I was like, yeah. Like, do you want to do this? Shit. Another guy saying that he's going to do something, started talking to her more and more about it. And here we are now, a year and a half, 2 years later, and we've got posters and t-shirts and friends and supporters of the film, and it's growing. And with the help of, like I said, people like yourself, if you enjoy the film, just tell everybody. And that's all it takes. I believe that, because this is my way to not get back at Hollywood, because I'd love to be a part of it, but to, make sure that I have my stuff, if people enjoy it, has a loud enough voice that it gets pushed forward. And luckily we have some good stuff going on this month, but I'll tell you about that in a minute. I hate to ramble, so I'll stop myself. Unless you stop.
No, it's fine. It's all good stuff. We like to. I think a lot of our listeners like to hear where the background comes from, and maybe the trials, because a portion of our listeners are in LA right now trying to break into Hollywood, and I think your insights and stuff for some of the trials that they're going through now.
I wish them the best of luck, and anybody out there that. And I hate to be preachy, because it's not my intention, but, one thing at least I stand for, and whether I've made it or not, and if you value, if someone judges me based on whether I drive a Mercedes or I've got a 3-picture deal, then I'm always going to fall short, And that's not really what I want to be valued on anyway. But if you value somebody who fights the good fight and sort of can take something from that, as I take by watching other people who do it, we were even just talking just before this about Brett Favre, football player. A lot of people may be like, oh, it's a football player. But you're looking at somebody that, fights the good fight. And it's a guy who's just a tough guy who just sticks it out no matter what. And those kind of people are important, and I think it's important to follow that. So anybody in L.A. or anybody else trying to do something, even if it's just you're trying to get a job as a manager at some store, just fight the good fight. Do your absolute best until there's nothing left. And if you don't get it, at least you fought. At least you tried,
That's all good stuff. Maybe more turning back to the film a little bit. Did you have any funny outtakes?
Oh, yeah, all the time, of what? I mean, every scene. I mean, as you may be able to tell at points when I mention porn, I'm not the most serious person in the world unless you get me serious. So, a lot of in-between takes, we're always laughing. Like, the whole thing was, just a lot of laughs. And I know it seems kind of crazy, the type of movie that it is. But, you'll see there's behind-the-scenes pictures on I have a community site called DBP TV that everyone, who listens, I'd love you guys to join and participate, just to be, we have a great community, so that you can get to from the main site. So that thing has, a lot of behind-the-scenes pictures, and you'll see in a lot of the pictures, everybody's laughing and putting fingers behind each other. Because it's 5 minutes, you're real serious, and then you go back to it, whatever. I mean, episode 4, which is all these guys chasing her through the woods and everything, those guys are the biggest bunch of clowns you've ever met. They're not a bunch of serious killers. I mean, you couldn't work with people if you couldn't laugh, I mean, I'm more from a comedy background, and I like to surround myself with people who are, silly. Like, I don't know what your audience is, Jason, but it takes every bit of willpower not to curse every 2 seconds. Because I can't. Because I have a fucking...
Well, you can.
Because I have a fucking potty mouth. I have, like, you know, like, if I had a potty mouth, it would be like a latrine mouth or something, like one of those military barracks where there's, like, you know, 20 toilets, because it's not good. So we had a good time, is my point. And everybody was really cool. I gotta say, it's just like, even the father who you think is like, oh, he's scary, he's like such a nice guy, he's like, you know, totally like neurotic, and like, it's a blast, you know. I've had a great time making it, it's just been really tough.
Well, that shows a lot, though, to their talent to be able to be goofy 1 minute and then turn completely serious and film a great scene the next.
Oh, I agree, but it shows that they're pros, you know, especially like Marissa Parnas, the star of the show. She's a total pro. I mean, she knows when it's time. We all know when it's time to stop fooling around. And on a beat, you know, you're in the scene, and you believe it. And they're really there. Sometimes it's really kind of on their ability to transform is uncanny. I just get blown away by their performances, and even Erica's artwork, which is acting too. I'm always sort of pleasantly surprised by things. It's like bonus, you know. It's awesome.
So eventually you're hoping to release this on maybe a full-length DVD or still hoping to maybe get it in theaters at some point?
Well, you know, definitely there'll be a DVD, for sure. I always tell people to, you know, join the site, because then I can keep people updated on what's going on when DVDs come out, because they will. And, you know, I'm doing the next month, December, which is pretty much this month coming. I'm doing a screening for Industry, which, you know, hopefully goes somewhere. You know, that would be, you know, you invite your HBOs and this and that, and hopefully they come and they see the potential for this, and either they want to remake it or turn it into a series itself where each one of these episodes becomes an hour-long thing, or, you know, expand on it, which isn't hard. Or, you know, release it as is, because, you know, it's not shot in DV, it's shot in high def. Looks good, at least I think so. Maybe get it released itself. I mean, why not? And maybe get into theaters, and maybe a small run, or maybe on cable. I'm not sure. I'm not really closed to any possibilities. And I think it's got great video game potential as well, you know? And I hate to sound like some marketing guy, I see it for what it is.
Well, is there anything else you want to tell us about the Drawn by Pain? Or?
Well, like I said, you know, I love it when people come by the site, you know, and hang out and become part of the community. And we got a good group, you know, and not just because they're part of something that I'm doing. They're actually a good group of people. And I don't know if you've had a chance to check them out, but they're just real nice. And I believe in, you know, everybody sort of teaming up and something good happening. And if you love the movie, then, you know, join the mailing list, you know, so on and so forth. Come hang out. I'd love it. This month we got a couple cool things coming up. All this on more credit cards. We've had a couple good press things. Press, which is awesome. That means we're getting on the map, which is fantastic. I mean, if you look on the main site, you'll see DVP in the press. You'll see some articles about us. And we've got a national radio show coming up. We have next Thursday night at 1 a.m., so it's really Friday morning, Eastern time. It's the Joey Reynolds Show. He's like a famous DJ, somewhere on AM. I know it's nationally syndicated. So, you know, we should have at least a couple hundred thousand people listening to that, which is awesome. And
good. I mean, with that kind of numbers, even if you get a small percentage, it's still a large number.
Oh, I agree. This is fantastic. I'm not knocking it at all. I think it's the greatest thing ever. And hopefully I come across well, and I'm not nervous and insane and neurotic. But that wouldn't be so bad either, because that's me. And we also have the New York Anime Festival, which is a convention here in New York, much like Otakon or Comic-Con or one of those. A little smaller, but it's going to be anime stuff, and we have a booth there, and we're going to have two monitors playing Best of Animation, and huge banner that's just Drawn by Pain, and flyers with newspaper articles and cards and T-shirts, and, you know, just getting the word out there and doing whatever we can to make that happen, and hopefully there's more press on the way, but we'll see. Crossing my fingers, dotting my T's, I's, crossing, slashing, burning, whatever you got to do, you know, because I want to live this dream as far as, like, I don't want to go to some shitty day job for the rest of my life. You know, I fought real hard not to have to do that. I want to go to the day job that's hard work, but that's what I'm supposed to do, if I can. We'll see.
Just to run down the websites, drawnbypain.com.
Like, drawn as you're drawing a drawing, DRAWNBY, pain, PAIN. Like, I got a pain in my stomach from all this debt.
we like to do a segment called Rapid Fire. And it's just five questions, and you just answer off the cuff.
Do I seem like the kind of guy who's going to have a problem with Rapid Fire?
No. Okay, not at all. So if we'll do that real quick, and then I'll actually open this up, and anything else you want to talk about, it, you're more than
like
welcome to.
Do a therapy session and pay you. I'm just kidding. Please.
First question, anything you're currently reading or listening to?
Watching or listening to? Whew. Like I said, I just saw Beowulf. I listen to a lot of sort of movie soundtracks and techno, and I'm building a lot of music. I'm a pretty eclectic guy, so I listen to just about everything. As far as watching, I watch a lot of HBO. I love HBO. I think it's really pretty innovative. I watch Curb Your Enthusiasm to relax me. I watch football when I want to feel like not such a geek and macho it up a little bit. I play video games. I play a little of, I play a lot of Halo, which is unfortunate because I need to get back to work. And that's about it. I'm just focusing on the movie mostly. But, you know, to distract myself, I like to do little sort of frivolous, stupid things.
Now it gets tougher. Describe yourself in three words.
I just looked at the cover for this DVD called Half-Baked. Right? So I was going to use Half-Baked, but I'm not really Half-Baked, but I thought it would be pretty funny. No, I'm not Half-Baked. I'd say energetic, passionate, and loyal.
Excellent. One person you'd like to meet?
Changes a lot. Not Brett Favre, though. That would be awesome. One person I'd like to meet. God, it's funny because. Well, can I ask you to give me a qualifier on that? For what purpose?
I guess just someone that you would like in your life that you would say, "Gosh, you know, I'd like to sit and have a chat with him."
I'd say Howard Stern if he wasn't on the radio.
Okay.
On the radio, he'd scare the shit out of me. So I did go up to Sirius yesterday. Yeah. The other day, I got to go up to the studios and see all the studios, and they're amazing. They're like all glass, and I was like 5 feet from Frankie Valli, the 50s star. I was like, holy shit, that's Frankie Valli.
Okay.
Awesome. So I'd say Howard Stern just because the guy is so fucking interesting and so open about everything, and his career he's led is so like amazing. I'd really just love to pick his brain and find out who the real person behind all that, you know, personality is. I think that's fascinating.
That's a good answer. And the last one is, if you had unlimited power to change one thing in the world, what would it be?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, you know, I'd want to say poverty, right? But it can't be poverty, because if you change poverty, then you just give people more money to be able to blow each other up. So I'd say if I change it, I'd change relations between people. In other words, like,
okay.
You know, you can include war, you can include, you know, the way that people get along in the street. You can, you know, I'm sure Wisconsin's a very nice place. But, you know, I'm from New York, and I've been in L.A., and I've been and sometimes the way people treat people, just in general, as far as respect. As far as being good to one another, I think it's a real shame that as human beings, you know, we have all these religions, we have all these, you know, rules of man, and yet no one treats each other well. So if I could change one thing, it would be that people are a little bit better to each other.
That's excellent. Well, if you have anything you'd like to add.
Can I get 65?
You, absolutely.
Tell my mom. She'll never believe it. I never get a 65 in anything.
Yeah.
I was a terrible student. It was awful. I'm a high school dropout. Throw that in there. I went to one of the best public schools in the country. I got into this like super smart kid school, and I totally fucking bombed out. I was like, what do you mean?
Wow.
You do 6 hours homework a night? I'm like, I'm not doing shit. I can't just come to class. This sucks. So I left early and then went early to college. I was like, this sucks. Got my GED, good enough diploma, but I have my master's degree to balance it. So I try to be this duality. Because it makes me sound like pretentiously important, which I'm not.
Does anyone question the GED when you throw that you have the master's out first?
No, I don't even like even tell. Who cares? I mean,
yeah.
It's not like you're applying for, you know, a corporate job, but even then nobody cares. They care your experience
right.
level. They care where you went to school as far as college. Who cares where you went to high school and where you got GED? And you know, that's not a stopping point. Like people get GED, so what? It doesn't really mean much. What means is what you do after that.
I agree.
So as far as anything else, like I said, we got a lot of stuff coming up, and we're just looking for some good times with some good friends. And I'm just very positive about the next. Today I'm going to pick up the banner for the show, which is like drawn by Payne in like 5 foot by 3 foot. It's awesome. So, you know, see if my credit card bounces when I get there. I'm just super excited, and next week is the convention and the radio show. So hopefully the radio show goes great. And it's just, it's a nervous time for me. You're catching me at an interesting moment in my life. And I'll probably listen to this podcast or however you put it out there later, if everything goes well or goes badly. But this next month and a half is probably the most crucial time I've ever had for my career, because I finally put myself in a position where people may listen to what I have to say and may see the vision that I've tried to put forward. And by the way, my first thought for people I'd most like to meet would be like Stanley Kubrick. I think he's brilliant. I just didn't know anything about him, so if I didn't want to answer and be like, yeah, I want to meet Stanley Kubrick, and like, what if he was a jerk? What if I wanted to take that back?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good one. I mean, we've had other people that we've interviewed say people that have passed away, and I think there's a lot that could be learned from those people.
I mean, that guy was a genius as far as, like, there's a couple of filmmakers that I think are really brilliant, and he's one of them, especially because here's what I tried to do in this film, and I'm sure I'll mention this again when other people ask me, to sort of formulate in my head what the type of film that Drawn by Pain is. And it's a film that's very singular in its perspective. And what I mean by that is, on most films that you see, they don't have a perspective. They have a main character, but they don't necessarily have a perspective. And I'll give you some examples of films, and if you've seen them, you can tell me if you agree that these things have very specific points of view. And one of them is Clockwork Orange. Have you seen it?
Yes. Yeah, Clockwork Orange, we reviewed just recently on our show as a cult classic.
And don't get me wrong, it's a really brutal film, and it's very tough to watch. But it's got such a unique point of view. You really feel like the character, even though he's a monster, and that's so interesting. And if you also look at Apocalypse Now, same thing. It's like you're going down the river, and you are him. So I'm just really fascinated by that type of filmmaking. That's not the type of film I would always make, but Drawn by Pain is supposed to be very similar, as whereas you're supposed to be sort of in the head of this woman, whether she be a woman or she's more of a person, you know? And you go through the emotional trials and tribulations and try to see if these things will destroy her in the end. It's, you know, she is, the tagline for the film now is, you know, how do you fight the enemy when you are the enemy? And I am always, for me, the battle from within is so much more interesting than the battle, you know, from outside.
It's very, very true.
We all go through everybody, you know, every day. So there's something, everybody fights themselves in one way or the other. And you're the person you have to spend the most time with.
Well, it's an interesting concept when you get that power. At what point do you go across the line of it, of using it beyond what you should be?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a... I mean, Spider-Man sort of touches on that. You know, with great power comes great responsibility. But not in the sort of, doesn't really touch upon it as much in the moral sense or in the personal sense.
So you see Spider-Man floating around New York very often?
I haven't seen him. But if I do, I'll make sure to call you back and, you know, have another whole show about it. Because it's at that point that you really will need to give me some therapy.
Well, if you get a picture, though, you'll probably make enough money to pay your credit cards off.
If I'm actually taking pictures of Spider-Man, then I'm probably Peter Parker himself, because only Peter Parker gets pictures of Spider-Man. But I couldn't tell you that, because that would reveal my not-so-secret identity now that I've blown it up to your audience. Awesome. Good job, Jeff. Score.
Well, I give you a heartfelt wish that you this next month goes well, and you can hopefully come back on our show someday in the future and tell us about it.
Glad you like the movie. That's very nice of you to say, and glad you're tuning in and that you're digging it. That's cool. Very cool of you.
Excellent. Be waiting for the next episode.
It's coming soon. The next couple of weeks, actually.
Excellent. Well, I hope you have a good rest of the day, and hopefully we'll
talk
again sometime.
Thank you for everybody to listen. Appreciate it.